This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2020. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The haunting specter of COVID-19 has been ever-present throughout the year. COVID-19 is the disease that's the result of being infected with the novel SARS coronavirus 2. The World Health Organization first declared COVID-19 to be a global pandemic on March 11th. According to Johns Hopkins University, the worldwide death toll from COVID-19 so far is well over 1.5 million people, with thousands of people dying each day from the disease. Our topic for the March 28th edition of Encounter was the U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic. My guests for the program were John Fortier, Director of Governance Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. According to a story published on March 20th in the Washington Post, U.S. intelligence agencies were issuing classified warnings about the coronavirus in January and definitely by February. The Trump administration was criticized for its slow and uneven response to the crisis. I asked John Fortier and Jim Kessler what mistakes they thought the administration made in addressing the pandemic and if there were any positive aspects of the U.S. response to the COVID-19 crisis.
Look, I think the president has done some things well and done some other things, you know, we could have done better. One thing that the president points to, and again, I think the country's divided about this, but the president points to him cutting off travel with China in a very early time, much earlier than Europe did. So that's something I think the president can point to. We also can point to the fact that the U.S. was slow on moving towards testing, and there were some false starts. I do think, though, that has come around in a way. Earlier would have been better in all circumstances. But the one thing I think the president has done fairly successfully has been marshaling the resources not only of the government and the state governments, but of the private sector. And the move towards lots more private sector work in the realm of testing has made the United States now, today, be a leader in testing. Again, all of this, I think the president will be judged as to how it goes as we go down the line. I think the president's too optimistic to say that he wants to have things opened up by Easter, although I don't think he said that as a definitive deadline. I think he's right to say that we are going to have to figure out how to have our economy and how to move back eventually. If he does so too rashly, I think that will be a big problem for the country and obviously for his fortunes. But that is something that we will have to wrestle with going forward. And clearly the president does want the country to come together. Look, I think also governors have had significant leadership, governors on both sides. And, you know, interestingly, the president, I think, has had, aside from some side comments here and there, some actually decent relationships with the governors. And there is a sense that the Congress and the governors and the president are at least pushing in a direction that's helpful. But again, this is a terrible crisis, one that's only going to get worse. And, you know, we'll have to see at the end of the day how we judge the response.
Jim Kessler, turning to you for your take on the U.S. response to this coronavirus pandemic.
I think the president got off to a slow start on this, a very slow start. And this is one of those crises where time is not a friend. And that slow start, I think, is going to be lethal for people's physical health in this country. And it's going to be very damaging for the economy. He started when this crisis was gathering as being not a believer. He wasn't really taking it that seriously. He was very, very much downplaying it for far too long. Look, if he was a 19-year-old, he would have been one of the kids on the beach in Florida during spring break. And there are a lot of people in this country who, especially early on, did not think that this was going to be that serious. Since then, he has mostly come around, but we wasted valuable, valuable time. I want to give him credit and the administration credit on a few things. First of all, the Federal Reserve, which is independent, but the Federal Reserve has reacted aggressively to try and stabilize the financial sector and to inject money into the economy and to protect businesses, and did it at a faster pace and at higher levels of spending than even during the financial crisis of 2008. So the Fed deserves some high marks. The stimulus package that was negotiated by Speaker Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, and the White House, particularly Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, that is a good opening package that will help people. It's going to provide direct payments to tens of millions of Americans, It's boosting unemployment so that people will receive close to what they would normally get. It is going to hopefully keep businesses having folks on the payroll as much as possible and prevent the shuttering of small businesses and large businesses as well.
Widespread demonstrations broke out across the United States in late spring and early summer against police violence and racial injustice after George Floyd died in police custody on May 25th. Defund the police was a key slogan that reverberated among protesters. To talk about the state of policing in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, two distinguished analysts joined me via Skype for the June 14th edition of Encounter. One was Reggie Miller, president of the Nashville, Tennessee chapter of the National Black Police Association. The NBPA is a nationwide organization of African American police associations dedicated to the promotion of justice, fairness, and effectiveness in law enforcement. And Sam Fullwood III, a senior fellow for politics and elections at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal policy group based here in Washington. The protests encompassed a multiracial and ethnic coalition. So I asked my guests if the protests marked a turning point that could catalyze much needed police reform across America.
I think change is inevitable. I'm probably not quite as sanguine about it as Reggie and a whole lot of other people are. I'm not contradicting what he said at all. But I think because I have seen supposed movements for change burst into the scene, garner a great deal of attention, and then die down once the news items change the subject. And so I would like to see whether this is actually going to have the legs that a whole lot of progressive people would like for it to have. The reason I'm somewhat wary about being a little bit too euphoric at this being a really definitive moment is that the demands that people are making for change would have to work through a political system that is dysfunctional. And unless we figure out a way to make our politics work, the change may get stymied. It may be creating a latent form of anger only to erupt in another way going forward. One other thing I'd like to say about the change moment. One of the things that really struck me about what has happened in the past couple of weeks has been the universality of the anger and the outrage, which we haven't really seen in this country before. And that's giving lift to people thinking that that's going to happen, that change is on the precipice. But I think that we have been slowly building toward this moment because of demographic change that's taking place in the country. And I think this is kind of an eruption of the fact that the country is rapidly becoming less white male dominated and more diverse. And the people that you see in the streets over the past couple of weeks in all the major cities and around the world reflect the fact that the world is changing from being one where Western white maledom has been the dominant force of what's going on.
Reggie Miller, let's go back to policing in America. There has been accusations of systemic racism. How pervasive is racism in U.S. policing? What's your view?
I would definitely say that it's, in a lot of the cases, it's definitely more than just a few bad apples. Sometimes it is rotten to the core. And I think that is why people are talking about a total reform, totally breaking down the police department, trying to get it to reestablish itself on a totally different thought process that it has been for the last hundreds of years. And yes, I can speak to that personally because back in 1992, when I was working undercover, I got pulled over for an expired tag that the department had given me a vehicle to drive, and it had expired tags on it, which I didn't know. I got pulled over by some of the same guys that was in my roll call room that day. And from that, I got pulled over. There were five guys were on this traffic stop for an expired tag. And I got pulled out at gunpoint. I got, you know, choked. I got kneed in the back. I got my eyes gouged. I got kicked in the groin. And so I pursued this brutality. Of course, we were only about 10% Blacks on the police department. So now it became a separation of Blacks and whites because the Blacks supported it. You know, me standing up, me standing out, which I wasn't supposed to do because it's this thin blue line. You're supposed to take a couple of days off and they pat you on the back and just say, hey, you know, come back, man. We sorry. I wasn't letting that happen.
You're listening to the best of Encounter 2020 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Here's a reminder that Encounter is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/encounter and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Now let's get back to our program featuring the highlights of Encounter in 2020. Shortly after the election in Belarus on August 9th, thousands of citizens peacefully took to the streets in the capital Minsk and elsewhere to protest, despite a violent crackdown by security forces. President and authoritarian strongman Alexander Lukashenko, who has been in power since 1994, shortly after the former Soviet Republic of Belarus gained its independence, falsely announced that he garnered 80% of the vote, defeating his rival Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who was forced to flee the country for her and her children's safety. On the August 29th edition of Encounter, Stephen Nix, regional director of Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, and Laura Jewett, regional director of Eurasia programs at the National Democratic Institute, joined me via Skype to discuss the prospects for meaningful democratic change in this longstanding authoritarian regime, which is closely allied with Russia. I asked my guests if they were surprised at the massive popular protests that erupted in Belarus after what was widely seen as a rigged election.
Well, I can't say we were surprised, because going into this particular election cycle, we sensed that there was a change electorate developing in Belarus. And we saw this by the attention and the emergence of some new players to the scene. First was Tikhanovsky, a blogger, Sepkala, Babariko, people who hadn't been associated with the democratic forces or the opposition political parties in Belarus. So these were relative newcomers who were drawing huge crowds, and all based on a platform of change for Belarus. And that was a message that resonated among these people. So we knew that this election might be different. And in terms of the protests, I think all of us will agree that we were amazed and astounded at the scope of these protests, the numbers, the passion that people are exhibiting. Belarusians finally are casting aside what we described as a fear society and are no longer afraid to speak up.
Laura Jewett, let me ask you the same question. To what extent you may have been surprised at the massive popular protests that erupted right after the election results were announced in Belarus?
It has been fascinating to watch. And I think the big takeaway for me is that these events have been a reminder to never discount the democratic aspirations of a population. There has long been an assumption about Belarusians that they had sort of grown accustomed to President Lukashenko and that they were a conservative and kind of risk-averse group, that they preferred stability over uncertainty. But as Steve says, both IRI and NDI have done research in Belarus, and we found, starting really 5 years ago, that there was this change electorate that he referred to that was emerging. These are people who were dissatisfied with the status quo and who were open to political change as a solution. And earlier this year, as the election approached, it became clear that this change electorate was growing and becoming more politicized and politically active than ever before. And we saw this during the election campaign, as Steve said, new faces came out as candidates. Citizens stood in hours-long lines to sign registration forms for opposition candidates, and they turned out in the tens of thousands for opposition campaign rallies. And then when Lukashenko, seeing this and understanding that he was losing support, blatantly rigged the election, and then through repression and violence, both before and during and after Election Day, this only added fuel to the momentum. And I think that the takeaway, again, as I say, is to never underestimate the degree to which people want to be treated with dignity and with justice and integrity. Because what started as a sort of a spontaneous movement in support of a democratic election has now become a real movement in support of democracy.
The topic for the September 13th edition of the program was the recent rapprochement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. The United States brokered the deal known as the Abraham Accords between the UAE and Israel in return for a halt to Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. Joining me for this discussion via Skype where Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Hussein Ibish, a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. I asked both prominent experts for their take on this deal, its significance, and timing.
Short-term interests of the three parties appear to coincide with potentially transformative long-term implications. I mean, I think it's quite clear the timing in the case of two of them are driven in large part by electoral considerations, both with respect to Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu, although I suspect that however much hoopla and hype there is at this ceremony, it's not going to do Mr. Trump or Mr. Netanyahu much good politically. And in fact, it could actually hurt Netanyahu. It's not going to be good for his base. As far as MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, is concerned, I think it's a smart play. I tweeted out before, I think he, of the three, is the only one with a strategy, the only one who's not running for re-election, and the only one who is going to manage to really achieve a very concrete benefit out of this agreement, which is the delivery of F-35s, much more than a simple airplane. And while he had sought those aircraft for the last half dozen years or so, there's no doubt, even though the three may not want to admit it, that this was clearly a trade-off. So on balance, I think it's a win-win-win, although biggest win for MBZ. It's a lose for the Palestinians. Whether it is a transaction, as I've just described, or a transformation, as my friend Hussein Ibish knows, is going to depend on if and when others in the region decide to sign up. One additional point, I think it does reflect with a degree of empirical validity that I think Hussein and I would both agree on, that the region is changing. That under the cover of the Arab Peace Initiative, to which all the Arab states will continue to pay obeisance, each in their own way, at their own rate, their own time, a half dozen or so may well decide to negotiate separate and discrete arrangements, not discrete in the sense that they're private, but simply singular, separate relations with Israel.
Over to you, Hussein Ibish, for your take on the significance and the timing of the deal.
Well, I think it was a moment of opportunity where all three parties saw that they could get something they really wanted very quickly. The U.S. and Israel had gotten into a trap regarding annexation. The Trump Peace to Prosperity plan, which was issued in January, kind of invited Israel to annex large chunks of the West Bank. That would mean basically an end to the two-state solution, an end to the prospects for peace with the Palestinians under any recognizable circumstances, and it would have been very difficult. And I think Netanyahu kind of trumpeted for political reasons that he was going to do all of this, and then ran into the fact that this is a headache the Trump administration doesn't need right now. So I think Trump, having issued the plan and recognized Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem and Golan Heights, had done enough, and thinking about anything else as a second term issue at most. And Netanyahu needed to get out of it as well. Jordan was putting up a huge stink, and the United States, I think, was telling him, you know, really don't do this. And here comes MBZ, here comes the UAE with the proposition that they can begin the normalization process with Israel if they get a bunch of stuff they want, including the F-35s, including Reaper drones, including various other very high-tech American weaponry, which they have not been able to access. And they see Israel also as the natural partner, not only against Iran, but against Turkey and Sunni Islamists, and as another sort of tech hub in the Middle East. UAE is very fixated on the idea of becoming a major tech commercial center. And they've gone pretty far in that regard. And when they look around the region, Israel seems the natural partner in that too. So on the one hand, he could do this. On the other hand, he could say to the rest of the Arabs, look, we're saving the two-state solution. We're saving the Arab Peace Initiative. We're saving the Palestinians from the threat of annexation. We're taking one for the team, which is a bit disingenuous, because what they're really doing is pursuing their national interests in a very focused way without really paying too much attention to other details.
At the urging of the outgoing Trump administration, several other Arab countries signed normalization agreements with the Jewish state before the end of 2020, including Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Along with the COVID-19 pandemic, the other key story this past year was the 2020 presidential and congressional elections. 1 month after former Vice President Joe Biden was declared the projected winner of the 2020 election, U.S. President Donald Trump continued efforts without success to overturn the results. Even though Democrats retained control of the House of Representatives, they did so with a slimmer margin. And by the end of the year, control of the Senate, the upper chamber, still hung in the balance, only to be determined by two runoff elections in the southern state of Georgia on January 5th, 2021. For now, Republicans hold 50 Senate seats, with Democrats holding 48. On the December 6th politics edition of our program, I discussed the Biden transition, President Trump's refusal to concede, and the Georgia runoff elections with our two veteran political analysts, John Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Even though Joe Biden garnered 306 electoral votes and gained 7 million more popular votes than Mr. Trump, the president refuses to recognize his loss. I asked Jim and John why they thought the president kept pushing to contest the election results in state legislatures, the courts, and the court of public opinion, and why so many Republican lawmakers remain silent rather than challenge him.
I think the election result is clear and isn't going to change. Joe Biden is going to be president on January 20th. All sorts of things you could point to on the Republican side that would be more positive than expected. Better results in the Congress, a better showing for President Trump. It was actually quite a close election in the Electoral College sense, similar to the 2016 election where then Donald Trump won three states by pretty close margins. This election came down to three states that Joe Biden won. Clearly, Joe Biden also had a bigger popular vote win. I think the early contention of the election was arguably warranted. We had a longer counting period and some issues that arose. But really, for the last week and a half, 2 weeks, I think the president's challenges, legal challenges and others really have been falling flat. And so I don't think there's anything that's going to change about that. And we're going to go forward. So again, there are people making arguments against what happened in the electoral process. Maybe there's some legitimate, and I think there are probably some legitimate questions about what we should do in the future and how we reform our election system. But I don't think there's any doubt. And so I think the president's efforts are really not going anywhere. And eventually, he said that when the Electoral College votes, and that's on December 14th, if there's a clearer result, he's going to accept that. I'm going to take him at his word at that. So I think maybe we'll have some resolution relatively soon. But again, I don't think the outcome is going to change, and Joe Biden will become president on January 20th.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, John Fortier makes a very good point that many of the down-ballot races were won by Republicans, contrary to what Democrats had wanted. But nonetheless, it's President Trump who continues to challenge the results. Why are so many Republican lawmakers not pushing him to accept these results? Because the attempts in the courts and challenging electoral officials in many of these key states has not been working.
So Donald Trump foreshadowed this at the Republican convention. He spent particularly the last day of the convention in his own speech talking about how this election is going to be stolen from him. And I think it was because of a belief by him and his advisors that there was no way he could win a free and fair election. I think they just felt they were not going to be able to win. So let's poison the water here as much as possible. And he is playing that out all the way through. I think what the president is doing right now, it's obviously wrong. I mean, virtually nobody who has an official Republican position believes that this election was fraudulent and that the election was stolen from him, except for a couple of crackpots. Unfortunately, President Trump is one of those crackpots, and I think this is doing some serious damage to the country and to our institutions that is going to be long-lasting. Nothing that Donald Trump is doing is surprising to me. What is surprising to me is the reticence of many Republican leaders to call him on it and say, enough is enough. And the truth of the matter is, they're still afraid of Donald Trump. They're afraid of him posting a negative tweet about him. My feeling is, if you're afraid of a negative tweet from Donald Trump, maybe you shouldn't be in office in the first place. Maybe you don't have the courage to be serving this country.
And that's Encounters Look Back at 2020. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks for listening today. And please join me again next week and next year for another encounter on The Voice of America.